Good morning and welcome to Talking of Books. I'm John MacDonald. My pleasure to welcome as well my co-host today, Litfest star extraordinary Yvette Judge.
Oh, thanks.
What else could we call you? Before we came on air, you were just giving us hints of some of the big names you've got lined up for Litfest 16.
Well, we've released some more names this week, so hopefully maybe later in the show we can have a look at those names and see who we can get excited about.
Well, I know you had our book champions today excited, and welcome back to what I call a hardy annual.
Oh, great to be here, John.
Rowan Roberts and Raya Bichari.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, indeed. And I know we're going to have a fun hour, always is, with you two from our Science Festival counterparts. And today you have chosen a book called Bold by Peter Diamandis and Stephen Kotler. So over to you. Tell our listeners what it's all about.
Right, so Bold by Peter Diamandis and Stephen Kotler is essentially a radical how-to guide for using exponential technologies, moonshot thinking, and crowd-powered tools to generate extraordinary wealth while positively impacting the lives of a billion people. So it's an exhilarating read. I quite enjoyed it. It's about how to think exponentially, how to think at scale, how to get into the flow state, how to change the world. You know, it's got grand, big themes. And broadly speaking, the book is divided into three parts. The first part looks at the kinds of exponentially growing technologies that will disrupt today's Fortune 500 companies, technologies like genetics, nanotechnology, robotics, artificial intelligence, 3D printing, sensors, networks, and so on, and allow young entrepreneurs to go from having a startup to having a billion-dollar company. The second part of the book looks at the psychology behind thinking bold, and it offers insight into how people like Larry Page of Google think, how people like Jeff Bezos of Amazon think, who else? Virgin's Richard Branson, and my personal hero, Elon Musk, founder of Tesla and SpaceX. So it offers this insight into how these people think and how what made them the great innovators that they are. And the final part of the book looks at how to leverage crowd-powered tools and crowdfund big major projects. So there's a lot to talk about. I'm looking forward to the show.
You're doing that yourself now for SciFest, I see.
In a way, yes, indeed. We're crowdfunding it, and we're trying to get this off the ground, and we're making some progress. But we can talk about that in a bit. But perhaps, Raya, you'd like to share your thoughts on the book?
Yeah, this isn't your typical book written by a typical corporate businessman. Essentially, the book contrasts exponential entrepreneurs against the usual entrepreneurs that you see. Peter Diamandis himself is a Greek-American engineer, physician, and he's best known for being the founder of the XPRIZE Foundation and Singularity University. And he says that we shouldn't define billionaires by how much money they make, but rather how many people they serve. A billionaire should be someone who serves a billion people and solves a problem that affects a billion people. And Stephen Kotler as well is an engineer and physicist and entrepreneur, an amazing writer. So together they bring this cosmic perspective to business, this cosmic perspective to entrepreneurship, and completely change how we see making money, how we see enabling technologies and solving problems in the future.
Yeah, he starts the book off with a wonderful analogy. He talks about the dinosaurs. You know, for 100 million years, the dinosaurs roamed the land, and they were the top dogs. They were the apex predators. And then the asteroid came along, destroyed them, and they went extinct. And the mammals took over. When the dinosaurs were roaming the landscape, mammals were these furry, small creatures scurrying in the underbrush. But once the dinosaurs were wiped out, it's now the mammals that have taken over. So there's a similar asteroid that's on the business landscape, and that's exponentially growing technologies. So the big companies, the big lumbering companies, the Fortune 500 companies, 40% of them will go extinct in the next 10 years. Why? Because of exponential growing technologies like 3D printing, like solar energy, like nanotechnology, and many others.
Well, we've seen that already. The attrition in Fortune 500 companies, even in the past decade, the past, certainly if you look at the past 50 years, and you compare Fortune 500 today, for there's no guarantee of survival.
Oh, just exactly.
A good example of that is the disruption being caused by Uber right now with the taxi companies. Taxi companies and cab companies are starting to realize that Uber is doing something really right. People would rather order a cab through an app instead of waiting out on the street. They'd rather pay by credit card instead of cash. And we're seeing all these protests with cab drivers not making enough money and so on. So it's a very good example of how advancing technologies is completely changing an entire industry and forcing people to adapt to this exponential change.
I'd say the music industry, another great example how that's been changed over the...
Exactly.
Again, within the past decade, I reckon.
Yeah, now everyone, instead of buying music, they're streaming them on Spotify and Apple Music. And even though some artists have been protesting against it, like there's all this drama with Taylor Swift going against Apple Music, but the truth of the matter is that you can't change it. Everything's being digitalized. And people would rather stream this data with their Wi-Fi and internet access that they have instead of paying to buy the music. And again, it's a shift in the industry.
And again, within our own context here, recurring theme, Yvette, as we know, talking about e-books, will they totally displace the printed version? We've got the traditional retail bookseller now being driven to extinction by Amazon.
Oh, but are they? I mean, I noticed that Foyle's Bookshop, which is probably the best-known bookshop in London, has opened a brand new, enormous branch in Birmingham. Now, they would not do that if they didn't feel that there was a market for it. And I think, the death of the printed book has been forecast for far too long now, and it's not happening. There's a place for everything. And, you know, you're talking about music, and it's quite interesting because, yes, if I want to listen to music, I will download it, I will stream it, I will do something like that. However, there's also the market for buying those round black flat things, as my children call them, which, you know, vanished, all but vanished. But now, again, there's a collector's market for those, and people want to own them. So I do think it's interesting because, yes, technology is there, technology changes things, but there's still almost that comfort feeling that people want of the retro, if you like.
Yeah. I think you're right. There is a huge market for printed books, but it's a temporary market. In the long term, in the long run, when you're talking 50, 100 years down the line, books are going to go the way of parchments, you know? And being sentimental about books is just as people in the Renaissance being sentimental about parchments. It's inevitable that e-books are the future. People of our generation, and we all love books, you know, we're book lovers, but we find comfort in holding a physical book. But if you look at kids today, they access the written word via a screen, via a tablet, and that's how they feel comfortable. So that generation, I mean, perhaps you disagree with it, but
he can see my face.
But you went to a librarian for nothing.
Just from my experience with young kids at school, because I'm an educator, kids are quite happy accessing the written word via a screen. It's us, you know, Generation X, baby boomers, who find comfort holding a physical book. But that's just my thought.
We're way off topic, but I'll get the last word in because I have to. I agree with you partially. However, I if you look at book sale figures, you will see that the huge selling end of the market is actually physical children's books.
Right.
And I defy anybody to find comfort with a toddler in an iPad rather than a physical book. And that's all I've got to say.
Right. Well, let's get back to Bold. And one thing that intrigues me is 3D printing. And that seems to be one of the threads a very strong thread running throughout the book.
Yeah, well, 3D printing is going to change everything. Peter Diamandis talks about how 3D printing is the third revolution in manufacturing. So the first revolution was the invention of the steam engine. And the second revolution was mass manufacturing under Henry Ford. That changed everything. And now what we're seeing is the democratization of products. You want something, you don't buy it, you print it. So that's going to change absolutely everything, because now you can print everything from cutlery to your clothes, even food. People in the International Space Station have a 3D printer, and they print stuff. When they run out of spare parts, they don't have a space shuttle taking things up to them. They just print it.
See, this makes my brain hurt.
What's amazing about it is that it makes innovation accessible to everyone. A few days ago, I came across a course that essentially lets you study how to make robots and 3D print the parts as you do it. So someone like me and you can buy a 3D printer, get all the parts, and build our own robot, print it out. And that's amazing if you think about it. You know, you can teach yourself to do anything. You can print anything.
Yeah, and not just that. You can use a 3D printer to print the parts to print another 3D printer.
Exactly.
So just imagine that.
No. You've got to stop now. Sorry. does this involve a lot of copyright issues? So if I've got my my handbag, something dear to my heart, and I popped it in my 3D printer with the requisite materials, and I produce one exactly the same.
Yeah, that's
What are the copyright issues on this? I mean, yeah. My longed for shoes with the red soles.
Well, that's a good point. I don't think that's been thought through yet, because these technologies are growing at such a rapid rate. The law and the legal systems haven't caught up with it. I'm sure somewhere down the line we will have laws to deal with copyright issues. But the long-term trend is to share. You know, we're living in a world where we share and share alike. So intellectual property and things, you can still patent stuff, but the trend is you got to just share on the open source stuff, you know?
Yeah. But it's interesting to think about how that transition would happen economically, because one of the most economically powerful countries are the ones that really implement IP laws and are able to protect those, because that's what causes the incentive for people to produce and create. So it would be, but I also agree that over the long run, sharing seems to be the trend and being open seems to be the trend. So it would be interesting to see how these two things battle out against each other.
Because taken to its logical extreme, if we're talking about sharing and you don't necessarily have rights over things, that I think for the industries, that the luxury industries, if you like, that trade on the uniqueness of an item, that's gone.
Yeah, they trade on people's gullibility.
Yeah.
If you're going to pay some eye-watering price just because it's got some designer's name on it, well, we'll fool you.
Yeah. Thanks, John.
But also,
but the time is already catching up with us. And stay with us. We'll be back very soon with more on Bold, a book that tells us how the world is changing.
Book Champion, only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
From Jane Austen to George Orwell, this is Talking of Books in association with Emirates Airline Festival of Literature, only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back to Talking of Books in our Book Champion slot with Ron Roberts and Raya Bajhari. And we're talking about Bold by Peter Diamantis and Stephen Kotler, which is described as a manifesto and a manual that on emerging technologies, thinking at scale, and the awesome power of crowd-powered tools. But before we get back to that, quiz question. And you get this right, and you'll be in the hunt to win a signed copy of a book by one of our LitFest authors. And as always, if you've been listening carefully, you've already been given the answer to the question. And that is, question is, Peter Diamantis is chairman and chief executive of a foundation that gives away prizes, $10 million prize for things like the first private space flight and a car that can do 100 miles per gallon. What is the name of the prize? It is the something prize. I'll give you another clue. It's only one letter. So text us on 4001 with the something prize by Peter Diamantis, that's chaired by Peter Diamantis, and you'll be in the hunt. All the correct answers go into the draw at the end of the show, and to win a book, signed copy of a book by a LitFest author. So let's get back to the book, Bolt. Ron, one thing that, let's see, is synthetic biology. This is a new one on me. Is this like GM? And I mean genetic modification.
Well,
not the car manufacturer.
It's essentially a combination of nanotechnology, biotechnology, and genetic modification. It involves creating machines and solutions at the nanoscale. One example is that the new cancer drugs that are tiny robots that go inside the body and deliver drugs to the source that's needed. Another popular trend in that industry is with clothing. People are... I just read about a company recently that's designing clothing for diabetic people so that their insulin levels are below a certain amount, the color changes. So at that nanoscale, they innovate and invent things that can help with what's needed.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And and also what people like Craig Venter are doing, I mean, he's the guy who helped decode the human genome. What they're doing is now literally creating new forms of life at the genetic level, you know, using the nucleic acids to create new forms of bacteria, literally species that have never existed before. Yeah. So that's another version of synthetic biology.
Yeah, and often these have a purpose to serve. Another purpose is with climate change. These bacteria can be used to control carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere.
Yeah, so. Or eat oil. So you have an oil spill, you release bacteria that just eat up the oil.
Mm-hmm. There's so much potential. You just never know. What
one of our listeners joining in and saying kind things about us. Thanks for the talk by all this morning. But he raised a very good point. This is thanks, Farouk, for bringing this up. So I've thought many times, is printing the right word for manufacturing things with 3D technology?
Mm.
Yeah, I think maybe that's why I find it hard to get my head around it. Yes, you're recreating something, aren't you? Rather than,
I think it's because it's a multi-layer. You start off with one layer and then you build it up infinitesimally till you get this.
Exactly.
So you really are printing layers.
You literally are printing. So it's an accurate description of the process because you're printing it layer by layer, cross section by cross section, and then it sort of builds up. So
but it is you are manufacturing, but printing is the process. To produce.
Exactly.
The production process is printing.
Yeah.
Rhea, you're considerably younger than me. Does any of this scare you?
Yes, but sometimes. Thing is, really with any form of technology, there's potential to misuse it. We were just talking about in our break how drones can be used to create weapons, but at the same time, they can also be used to deliver food to people who need it or resources to people who need it. So really, it comes down to the laws that we have, the policies that we have with how these technology are used. In general, there's a very good reason to why people are usually pessimistic in the future, about the future, and pessimistic about technology in general. A lot of people are scared by these innovations, and the media is partly to blame for that as well. Our brains have a region called the amygdala, which is the emotional region of our brain. And given the overwhelming amount of information that we are given every day, it searches for all the dangerous things, because survival is ultimately the most important thing to us. So naturally, there's this illusion that a lot of things are going wrong, but I feel like overall we're gonna do amazing with all these new forms of technology.
The one that you mentioned that really strikes terror into my little heart is the is creating new life.
Yes, but I feel like if you think about it, okay, why is that scary to you?
Because I have a fear that we don't know what we're creating, and I've read too many science fiction books.
Oh, that's good to hear. That I missed our science fiction special a couple of months ago.
And it's perfectly fine to feel that way. I feel like I love sci-fi because you can read the stories, these imaginary futures that they've created of how things could go wrong, and we can avoid them. So I could sit down with you and say, so tell me all the things that you think could go wrong with creating life. And we can think about ways we can prevent it, such as having policies of releasing artificial life out into the wild, out of nowhere, but keeping it in controlled environment.
Yeah,
until
how do you do
sure.
that, though? You know, for me, with a little bit of life experience, not just from science fiction, but from things that have really happened, it does scare me, without doubt. If you think about the viruses that have been eradicated but are still kept in labs, you've got smallpox, things like that.
Yeah.
And you know, there have been occasions when there have been big scares there, so I actually think it's in in the real world, it's impossible to contain everything, and we can have as many policies and we can be as lovely as we like. However, the reality is that a lot of people are not lovely.
And
a lot of people
right.
are not going to hold on to those policies. Right. So for me, it is a scary glimpse into the future. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a lot of it is really exciting. And, if I think of the way that probably for our generation, I suspect that the world has changed more than for any other generation in the past. If I think back to when I was born and what there was and to what there is now, if you looked at 200 years ago, somebody who'd lived as long as I have, they wouldn't have seen that many changes. Whereas for me, it's huge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just going back to the conversation we were having earlier about synthetic life, Freeman Dyson, the physicist, talks about how the next generation of poets and artists will be creating new forms of life in the same way Blake and Byron wrote poetry mm-hmm. and verses. So I can imagine a future where kids in kindergarten will be writing codes to create new forms of flowers instead of using crayons to draw them. They would actually be creating it. And
it's a bit frightening if you look at some of the creations in Blake's art.
Exactly. Yes,
it certainly is.
if he now brought them into existence.
I go back to Dave the Triffids and rest my case.
But germane to this discussion is what Plato wrote in his dialogue Phaedrus, in which he has Socrates narrate the story of the god of the underworld, Theus, who is having a conversation with, I believe it was Ammon, one of the god kings of ancient Egypt. And Theus was the god of numbers and writing. And he was trying to explain to the Egyptian king that this would be a great gift for mankind, this technology of writing. And Ammon was like, no, it would atrophy people's memory and it would ruin the way we do things. And he was arguing against giving mankind the gift of writing. And Theus was arguing that, no, this is a good thing to offer man. So imagine we didn't have the technology of writing. Where would we be today? So sitting here in the early 21st century, we have all these fears and concerns, much like the Luddites in the early 19th century were afraid of technology.
I know I'd have been a Luddite. I'm fine, I'm good with that.
But imagine the Luddites had their way, and they were going around destroying factories and destroying machines. Where would we be today if the Luddites had their way?
True, but you can understand their motivation, their rationale, that they were going hungry, and they could see their jobs, their future, mm-hmm. everything just ending. Machines were taking over.
Yeah, it wasn't just a fear of the future for them. It was actually, they were starving.
Mm.
That
right.
They had no jobs,
but
and that again is happening now.
Yeah, it is happening now. But I think if you probe this whole phenomenon a little more, there was an article that was posted on the Intelligent Optimism page, which said technology is actually creating more jobs. Mm-hmm. So all the mechanical jobs that are highly dangerous are being taken over by machines, which allow humans to be involved in more higher order creative jobs. And also offers us more leisure time. So there
time again. This is another break on us, and it seems just half a minute since the last one. So stay with us. We're having real fun here on Bold by Peter Diamantis, and a lot more to come.
Book Champion, only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
From Leo Tolstoy to Mark Twain, this is Talking of Books, in association with Emirates Airline Festival of Literature, only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back to Talking of Books, in our Book Champion slot with Rowan and Raya telling us about Bold. And a bold book it is, and prompting a lot of discussion in the studio, and our listeners joining in. Apropos our earlier themes, Yusuf is asking, will smart watches replace traditional watches in coming years? No, not having either, I don't know.
I don't know, Raya, you live in Boston. What's it like in America?
Honestly, for younger people, I feel like phones have already replaced all kinds of watches. I feel like even the smartwatches, I haven't seen as many young people wear. Some people wear it because they're techies and they like to have all the Apple gadgets. But I'm convinced that phones have replaced watches once and for all. We can tell the time by looking at our phones.
Yeah,
but that's just my personal experience.
A watch is still a beautiful thing, though, isn't it? I think people who wear watches wear them because they actually like.
Yeah, but you can also tell which generation people who wear a watch belong to. Because you and I, Yvette, we're wearing watches, so is John. But
no,
I noticed that Raya
is not.
I've never had a watch. Is it what's the point? I've got a phone here that gives me the time every time I look at the dial.
Yeah.
Exactly. Where do you think the cutoff comes age-wise, then?
I feel like 18 and under.
Okay, right now, the non-watch generation.
Yeah, gradually.
Yeah, the millennials.
It's fizzling away,
the millennial generation.
Yeah.
But just coming back
I hardly qualified. I haven't. I can't remember the last watch.
You're the exception, John. You're not the norm.
Even before phones, a watch is an old... Why? That you've got wherever you go. There's a clock, or you've got it on the radio in a car, or wherever you're going. Or if you become time aware, you don't need a watch.
Exactly.
Yeah. You see, I find it really hard not to wear a watch, and along with earrings. If I go out with either, it's
you're
trauma.
In front of a screen, and your screen, your laptop or desktop, whatever you're working on, gives you the time in the bottom corner. So. Yeah.
True.
So you're just ahead of your time.
Watches are redundant.
But they're beautiful.
If that listener Alistair takes you to task and saying, I dislike reading from a screen and doubt that I would ever buy a Kindle, but I have to disagree that kids prefer hard copy books. My 3-year-old will sit in front of an iPad for hours, unfortunately, but will only sit still for 2 or 3 books at most.
I agree. I have a little brother, and he's exactly the same.
I'm sorry, you've got to retrain that child.
It's a losing battle.
Yeah. I will fight for this.
But just coming back to the book, I mean, one of the key themes of the book is exponentially growing technologies. And for a lot of people, the word exponential doesn't make much sense. So perhaps we could spend a couple of minutes talking about what exponential really means. And how it differs from linear growth. So linear growth is growth which grows by adding a factor. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Exponential growth is growth by multiplying a factor. So it's 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, and so on. What does that mean? So in his earlier book, Abundance, he gives this wonderful example of how if you took 30 linear steps, you would reach 30 meters away. But if you took 30 exponential steps, you would reach 1 billion meters away, enough to circle the globe 26 times. So that's one way of looking at the difference between linear growth and exponential growth.
Yeah, and a consequence of that is that right now the cell phone that you have in your pocket is 1 million times cheaper and 1,000 times faster than the supercomputers in the 70s. So the speed at which computers are growing and becoming more efficient is itself doubling. So that's something to think about. You can just imagine the consequences that would have over the next 20 or 30 years.
Slowing down, that was Moore's Law.
Yeah, Moore's Law.
And reading some of that, Moore's Law is now slowing down.
Is it?
Oh, is it? I thought it was... In some areas, it's actually expanding up to 6 times.
Yes, the capacity was doubling and the price was halving.
Mm. Right.
In what, every year?
Every 18 months.
18, whatever period it was.
I guess it also depends on the industry that you're talking about.
True.
And the form of technology, too. Like right now, we're seeing a shift from PCs to iPads. So it could really depend. And then you have the information sector of the tech industry. So there are very different many different sectors within the tech industry.
Let's look at genetics. So it took us 11 years to decode the HIV virus, and it cost hundreds of millions of dollars. It took 11 years to do that, but with the SARS virus, it took us less than a month. So that's the difference. Where's 11 years to decode HIV and 30 days to decode the SARS virus? Same with decoding the first plant genome. They did it in 2000, the year 2000, for the first time. It took 7 years, cost $70 million. Today, you can do it for $100, and it takes you 3 hours. So in some industries, exponential growth is just quite phenomenal. And it's not just the 18 months. It's way, way beyond Moore's Law now.
Yeah, and we're starting to see the same pattern with decoding the human brain. President Obama recently launched several new projects, like the Human Brain Project and the Connectome Project, which are essentially mirroring the same patterns of decoding that we had with the Human Genome Project on the human brain. And even with that, we're starting to see exponential growth in how we how we code the patterns in the 86 billion neurons that you have and the trillions of connections that you have within the human brain. And that's going to change everything about how we understand ourselves and our nature.
Yeah, one of the other big themes is this idea of disruption, how these small, nimble, agile, young entrepreneurs are disrupting everything. And he gives the example of, say, Instagram. Mm-hmm. Instagram was founded in 2010 with just 13 people. And in 2012, just 2 years later, it was acquired by Facebook for $1 billion. So they went from launching in 2010 to being $1 billion company in 2 years. So that's an excellent example of an exponentially growing company.
And WhatsApp is another example.
Yeah. The Financial Times had a great piece. There's a continuing debate about Elon Musk and Tesla and the
which
electric
is such
cars.
Elon Musk is such a great name. Sorry, I have to say. he is the evil James Bond villain, isn't he?
Did you know
such
Iron
a
Man,
fantastic name.
Tony Stark's Iron Man is based on Elon Musk.
Exactly.
So the FT had done a typical fundamentalist approach in stock markets. Well, where is the underlying asset? That we have Tesla valued at $28 billion or something, when it's costing $40,000 to every car that and BMW is turning out cars again at an exponential rate comparatively. So how on earth can you justify the value?
The value of Tesla is Elon Musk. It's the man. People invest not in necessarily in his product, but in his vision. They buy into his vision. They buy into his passion. And he's just the most inspiring human being on the planet.
That was the counter argument. I think it was in yesterday's FT. That you either get on the bus or you miss the bus, and you cannot afford to miss the electric bus.
Exactly.
And Elon Musk is the man that's driving it at this stage. And if that in time to this works in time to come, it will look like the bargain of a lifetime. How did I ever doubt it? Why didn't I mortgage my house? And
true. I mean, he's the brains behind SolarCity as well. And today, in 2015, just 1% of America's energy needs is being met by solar. But solar technology is now an exponentially growing technology. So what that means is all it needs is 6 doublings and America can meet 100% of its energy needs through solar. And that means just in 14 years, so by around 2030, America can meet 100% of its energy needs through solar. That's quite extraordinary if you think about it. And Elon Musk is the man who's investing in solar like nobody else is.
And it's very smart to have that futuristic perspective from a business angle, because that means you're able to get on the market and monopolize it before you have competition.
Exactly.
And that's the really good thing right now, because there isn't much competition with electric cars. Yes, a few other companies are doing it, but the engineering is nowhere as amazing. And a lot of people say, when you look at ideas like Amazon or Instagram, you think, oh, that's so simple. I wish I thought of that. And Elon Musk has this amazing visionary futuristic perspective. So when people think that, they think, okay, I want to stay with him and invest in him. So in the future, when solar power is so much cheaper and it's this amazing multi-billion-dollar industry, I'm already settled in that industry. And that's a smart thing to think about from a business angle.
So, Ryan, last time you were here, you were still at school in Dubai.
Yeah.
And now you're at university in Boston.
Yes, I'm in Boston University.
Fantastic.
Doing neuroscience.
Go on. Digressing for a bit, give us your views. How long have you been there? It's your first term.
I just finished my first year of doing neuroscience in Boston. I have about 3 more years to go. And,
You're enjoying it.
Yeah, I love it. It's very fascinating. There's so much potential in neuroscience. We know more about the universe than we know about our human brain. So if you think about it, that leaves so much room for research, so much room for knowledge and figuring out. And there's so many. It's such a broad field. You have cognitive neuroscience, computational neuroscience, which essentially involves creating artificial minds, biological neuro. So there's so much potential. And it's starting to be a growing industry of its own. And I'm very excited to be a part of it.
Good. And you're back here seeing your family, I guess.
And heading back on Monday.
And I think it must be, what, around 4 years, 5 years now that...
5 years, yeah.
That Rhea was first on Talking of Books.
Oh, no, no. The first time we were on was January 2013.
Oh, okay. That was
it seems like forever, but...
Yeah. 5 years ago. No.
But you were on before. That was not your first time.
I think that was my first time as well.
It was.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's
only
2 years ago, it seems.
I seem to recall we were just desperate 1 week and, let's try Rowan.
Only joking.
Can I ask something? I think one of the things that is raised in the book, and one of the things that I know you've now got personal experience of, is crowdfunding. And I think maybe some of the listeners and me would be really interested to hear, in a nutshell, how that works, because it's quite almost an altruistic idea, which goes back to this whole sharing things and being lovely people. So can you just... tell us how that works.
Yeah, well, what's amazing about Peter Diamandis and his book is that he isn't talking from his ivory tower. He's actually done the stuff that he writes about. And one of the things he did was he crowdfunded the first publicly funded space telescope called ARCHID. How that worked was you use a platform like Kickstarter or Indiegogo, and you create a campaign. And publicize the campaign with the general audience, the public, and people who buy into your vision, who believe in your dream, help fund your project. So ARCHID raised $1.5 million in 30 days and had 17,000 people back it. And they're ready for launch in another couple of months. And it will be the first publicly funded space telescope.
So how do you do this? How do I publicly fund my world trip?
Right. Well,
so basically, you go on a platform like Kickstarter or Indiegogo. It takes a few minutes. You set up an account.
Just a minute. Whoa! You lost.
Okay. Yeah. So you sign
lost
up.
Me in some, yeah.
You sign up for Kickstarter or Indiegogo.
Okay. So I just Google Kickstarter or Indiegogo.
Indiegogo.
Okay. Indiegogo. Yeah, I think there are a few other platforms, but those are the two most popular.
So I can Google crowdfunding platforms.
Exactly.
Okay, right, someone there, right. Yeah.
And then you sign up for an account.
Okay, which is easy.
Which is easy. Yeah. And then you create a project.
Okay.
And usually people have a short video introducing their project that's 2 or 3 minutes long, or pictures and a bio about the project. You can select the kind of funding that you want. You can either have a fixed funding where you only get the money if you reach your goal. You set your goal.
Otherwise, it goes back to the people who pledged it.
Or it can be flexible, where you get whatever you manage to raise, and you select the different levels of contributions people can make, or the perks that they would receive. You can create incentives, such as if you donate this much, you get a free T-shirt, and so on. And after that, you just launch your project, you share with everyone you know, and he talks a lot about tips and tricks about how to promote it with your friends and family, and across cross promote in other platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and spread the word. Hopefully people are altruistic enough to fund your travel trips or so on. And that's about it in a nutshell.
So are there people out there who actively search for crowdfunding projects to put their money into?
There are in America, not so much in Dubai.
We'll have to come back to that how we can all get rich instantly. And we'll be back in a couple of minutes and we'll learn more about crowdfunding and Yvette raising the cash for her world tour.
Book Champion, only on Dubai Eye, 103.8.
In our Book Champion Hour that has been galloping by with great subject matter and great champions, and Rowan and Raya telling us about Bold by Peter Diamantis and Stephen Cutler. And our listeners are joining in too. Our own Chrissy back at Litfest office. I don't wear a watch either. Well done, Chrissy. And Elon Musk was horrible to his ex-wife, an unidentified listener tells us. Watch the NBC documentary.
Look, Elon Musk is not an angel. No one's saying he's an angel, right? We all have flaws. I mean, I don't know what sort of a statement that is. He was horrible to his wife. We hear from one side. We're talking about what he's doing for humanity, yeah. And we're talking about projects like Tesla and SpaceX and asteroid mining and big things. You know, okay, he had some issues with his wife. It's not my business.
Yeah, I think we're not talking about dating him. We're talking about the entrepreneurship that he's doing. And I feel like those are two very different things. You can be a very bad husband or boyfriend, which I don't know if he is, but an amazing innovator.
Yeah.
And that's what we're praising him for. And that you cannot deny.
Yeah, exactly. But sticking with the idea of disruption and what this book Bold is about, how exponentially growing technologies are disrupting today's Fortune 500 companies, he gives a wonderful example of Kodak. In 1995, Kodak was the undisputed leader in film. They had 140,000 employees. They were valued at $28 billion. In 2012, they filed for bankruptcy. Why? Because they couldn't keep up with the digitalization of film and photography. And that's a lesson for a lot of other companies to learn as well.
IBM, if you looked at the colossus of the computing industry in its time. No. Consultancy.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
I think another amazing shift.
Crowdfunding is where we were before the break. And we were going to get Yvonne off on her...
On my
is it Queen Mary II now?
There are a few other things I quite like to crowdfund. I'm just not sure people will buy into them. But I find it interesting that we were discussing off air that there are personal things that people do crowdfund. Veneering their teeth. So if you can persuade people that actually you could change your life, you could turn your life around by having something done. It may be something major. You may need heart surgery. It may be something cosmetic. That you can persuade people to do that fascinates me, because that's almost the power of the words and the visuals. So it goes back to what's dear to my heart. And that I love the fact that there are people out there who will think, hey, guy, that guy needs veneers for his teeth. It would change his life, and it probably did. And that people are prepared to put the money up for that. Things like that, the smaller things, gladden my heart, probably more so than funding a telescope. I'm really sorry.
I hear you. And you know, it takes all sorts. And it's nice that we have these platforms that allow people to help others, you know.
Yeah. Whether well, it's I'll for give you a case in point is in the past week or so. A woman in England who'd been stripped of her benefits, you know, what usual the Tory government now... people, how you do teaching people how to cope if people threaten to commit suicide as you've taken their benefits away. Anyway, this woman was starving. She stole 75p chocolate bar. So she's done for shoplifting. Not only shoplifting, then there are added, you've got to pay the court costs, £380 or thereabouts for stealing a 75p chocolate bar when she's starving. Mm. So a Scottish Independence website.
So, right. There's no bias here at all.
Can we help this woman out? Because clearly she can't even find 75 pence for a chocolate bar. She's hardly going to find £380, so she's off to Chucky. Within hours, it was £10,000and some change.
Whoa.
And the difference went to support Scottish food banks.
Yeah. Perfect.
And if you think crowdfunding is amazing, he also talks about crowdsourcing. So if you think about what it takes to start a company, there is not just the whole business angle, but branding it, designing a website, having a marketing team, having an office, and so on. So there's so many different things that go into it. And one person couldn't possibly have all the skills that it takes to do all those things. But Peter Diamandis talks about platforms where you could outsource these individual things to other individual freelancers who are skilled at them. So it really connects, for instance, people who are good at graphic design with entrepreneurs who need them. So with the internet, with access to information, you can sit behind a computer and work by having stuff like this outsourced to you. And that's another way you can collaborate.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And I know for your own SciFest project, you've been dipping your toes into the crowdfunding market, and I wish you lots of luck with that.
Oh, thank you. We need all the help we can get.
good. We've mentioned briefly a competition Do we want to remind people about that?
Yes,
the quiz.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
a little question.
Doesn't get your rewards on a crowdfunding scale, but perhaps a book by a Litfest author. You never know. If the books are consigned to the dustbin of history before long, this will become a very valuable antique. Should you win it for your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren. The question, apropos Peter Diamond and his foundation, that awards $10 million prizes for private space flight, a car that will make do 100 miles a gallon, and so on. What is the name of the foundation? And it's the something prize, single letter, foundation. Text us in 4001 and said a copy of a signed book by a Litfest author.
And ultimately, you only need to send 26 to at least get it right once. But I think if you focus on the end of the alphabet, you will have far more luck.
Yeah, you should do a deal on that, Yvette, and you get cut in the share of the the text costs. And fund your trip that way.
There's a thought. Oh, so it's all fascinating stuff this morning, actually. Whenever you're on the programme, I always end up with a slight brain ache.
But Ron, you're talking about Socrates and Ammon and the future of writing. Plato said that mathematics is how, define mathematics as the way God talks, the gods talk to mankind.
Oh, or it's mathematics is the language of the universe. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we were ever to encounter alien intelligence, we would use mathematics to communicate with them. You wouldn't use language.
It's the most objective form of communication.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting in the movie Contact, that's based on a novel by Carl Sagan. Essentially, that's how the aliens communicated with humanity, through mathematics and numbers.
And mathematics is, you know, the stuff that you can use mathematics to predict is pretty mind-blowing. For example, antimatter was discovered through equations on paper first. So the math said antimatter must exist. And then the scientists went out and discovered antimatter. The math said neutrinos must exist. And then much later, scientists discovered neutrinos. So a lot of the stuff that's being discovered in the Large Hadron Collider is now only on paper. You know, the mathematics says this should exist in reality. And then we go and discover it.
Higgs
same
postulate that the boson must exist.
Exactly.
And the Hadron Collider confirmed what the maths had
that's
suggested.
Quite interesting. Well, one of my issues at school was always, I always want to know why I need to know something. Mm. Now, sometimes it's I need to know it because I love knowing it, and that's fine. I always had an issue with maths, and it was why. And nobody could ever tell me why. Why do I need to know how to do these equations?
Because of X. That's why.
Exactly. That was more or less the answer I got. If it had been put to me in that way, it would actually have made a huge difference to my appreciation. Mm. I'm not sure it would have made me love maths, but at least having that, this is why. It's not purely to solve an equation, because that is the end result of that particular question. Yeah. However, looking further ahead, this is why. Mm. So, yeah, thank you for that.
All right.
Well, Yvette, if you look at that book I was just showing Rowan earlier, it's coming up as a book of the week.
Yes, The Universe in Your Hand.
And if you haven't read it already, do. It will help you catch up on all the
really
mathematical stuff.
Got a lot of catching up to do.
that you missed out on at school. And make it not only understandable, it makes it fun.
Yeah.
And I think if you'd had that at school, wouldn't have had that.
If someone could have told me why differentiation, I needed to know it, I'd have been so much
likewise,
happier.
Likewise, I hadn't a clue about maths or
I could
physics
do it
at school.
Because tell me why.
There was nothing there that caught my interest.
No.
And much older when I did discover what a fascinating world it is.
Mm. Exactly. Letters belonged in stories, not in equations. But I have learnt otherwise, and thank you. Thank you for making me think this morning.
Well, again, this hour, Book Champion Hour, has really galloped by, and I think it's always the case when we've got Rowan and Raya on and we're discussing matters scientific or mathematical discovery that the world around us is such a fascinating place, and this is what SciFest does to make it accessible to those, as we hope that Literary Fest isn't just for the converted, that it does draw people into reading.
Well, yeah, but actually we've got some fascinating sciencey things coming up at the Lit Fest next year, most of which I can't talk about yet, right. But I think we've got some great links with you guys for next March.
So, news coming up now, but stay with us and we'll be back after the news in our young reader slot. But we'll be Olivia Green will be telling us about Geek Girl by Holly Smale. I think, yes, what I've read of Geek Girl, she'd go down well with Hugh and Raya Ron. So, that's us for now. We'll be back in a few minutes with more Talking of Books.